The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Lieutenant General Russell Mulcahy is Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, appointed to that role on the 1st of June. And as he takes his role, he faces multiple issues. And of course, the issue du jour is that vote in the Security Council about the continuation or not of the UNIFIL mission in Lebanon. And I'm happy to say that the Chief of Staff joins me now. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat, and thanks for having me.
Now, it's just a coincidence that you're in here on the day that this vote is being taken. It was flagged that it was going to happen sometime around now.
Yeah.
But this is, it's not welcome news for the Defence Forces.
Well, I suppose it's not welcome, Pat, but it does give us a level of certainty and allows us to plan for the future. As you know, Ireland has had a long and unbroken service record with UNIFIL in particular, but also in our overseas service. We've been in UNIFIL since the start, 1978, and this is a step change in our overseas posture for sure, but one that we will plan for and we'll look to the future beyond UNIFIL. We'll stay there. It looks like now the mandate, the vote hasn't yet taken place formally, but when it does take place, it looks like we'll be continuing operations there until the end of 2026, so December 26.
I don't think it's any secret that Israel and perhaps backed by the United States would have liked it to end sooner.
They wanted it to end within 12 months, so a complete drawdown by August of next year. But we're now going to be there continuing operations, as I said, until December 26, and then a year after that for all of the contingents to withdraw from the mission area.
Now, it is hoped that it won't leave a complete vacuum there. They're hoping that the Lebanese army will do the job that you were doing. But, I mean, the Lebanese army has skin in the game, whereas the UN does not. I mean, the UN is an impartial, independent body.
It is. And the Lebanese armed forces are on the ground in the area of operations and have been for the last number of years. I suppose the recent conflict between Israel and Lebanon in particular led to a cessation of hostilities in November last year. And part of that agreement, that cessation, was that the Lebanese army would deploy up to 6,000 additional troops into the UNIFIL's area of operation or the south of Lebanon. So that work is ongoing, and the work the Lebanese army are undertaking is in close cooperation with UNIFIL armed forces and indeed our Irish battalion on the ground, our Irish Polish battalion on the ground in a critical area of Lebanon, in Bin Jebel area. So we work on a daily basis with the Lebanese Armed Forces, and there is a lot expected of them in the coming year and a half, when they will have to step up in a different way and take the lead, if you want, in those operations.
Now, what Israel was looking for, and therefore what the United States was looking for, was that UNIFIL would disarm the militias in the area. And of course, that is not the role of UNIFIL.
Well, I think the actual agreement is that the Lebanese government would take the lead in the disarmament of Hezbollah. And they've come out with a clear statement, political, which is really welcome, I have to say. And that will cause internal challenges for the Lebanese government. And certainly Hezbollah will have a different view on that. But that's something for the Lebanese government and the Lebanese armed forces to deal with. The UNIFIL mission, though, will provide support to the Lebanese armed forces as they search for weapons that are in the UNIFIL area. And those kind of operations are continuing and have been done for the last
while. Now, the importance of the UNIFIL missions for the Irish Army, I mean, you've been there for such a long time. It's been probably a critical element in the training of soldiers abroad to get experience, if you like, in areas of potential conflict.
Yeah, we've been there for over 45 years at this stage now, as I say, 47 years actually, and we've had over 30,000 people have served in Lebanon from all the three services, the Army, Air Corps and the Naval Service, predominantly Army. And as you say, that has provided an operational test bed for our personnel. That's where we train our young leaders, our soldiers and our enlisted leaders as well, in how to conduct operations in an operating environment.
I remember being out there years ago at Camp Shamrock, as it was then, the original one, and went out on a mine clearance exercise. Mm. And that is an area in which we now have huge expertise, much of it probably developed in Lebanon.
Absolutely, yeah. So both our ordnance personnel from the mine clearance and especially our engineer personnel and also our infantry soldiers who would support them as well. So a huge learnings, but also learnings in regard to the kind of warrior and the diplomat. So how to engage with locals. We do a lot on the in the civil military area where we provide humanitarian assistance or project work to people, but also basic leadership. So how to conduct patrols in an operating environment, how to deal with conflict, how to overcome and solve problems in a tactical environment. And it hasn't been without risk and without cause. We've lost 47 personnel as part of the UNIFIL mission. And we also have another mission in Lebanon, which is the UNSO mission, an observer mission. And one of our personnel was killed in that. So it has exacted a heavy price on our personnel. And we remember those people every month, actually. Our battalion out on the ground conducts a remembrance ceremony for the people who have died in that month in service in Lebanon.
Now, when the UNIFIL mission goes, what will replace it to give that kind of operational experience to the Irish Army?
That's a big challenge that faces me as Chief of Staff and also all of us in the senior leadership. But it won't be our first time that when we haven't had troops in Lebanon. I suppose people may have forgotten that. So in the mid-2000s, once the Israelis withdrew from Lebanon, we remained on for a number of years. And then we took our battalion out of the UNIFIL area. We kept some staff in headquarters. But there was a period there where we had no troop deployment in Lebanon, and we'd also drawn down in Kosovo. So it's not the first time that we haven't had an overseas mission. That will allow us actually to reset from an army perspective and develop, bring in the new capabilities that are part of the new Commission on Defence Forces and the level of ambition, as the government calls it, to allow us to train up on new capabilities and look for new missions overseas.
Was there a concern at one point that you mightn't have enough people to staff the UNIFIL mission because, you know, the depletion of personnel?
We have the numbers in the battalions have reduced over the years. So now we have a combined battalion with our Polish, Hungarian and Maltese counterparts. So we have 343 personnel in Lebanon and that does draw a heavy price on the army. Yeah, it is a difficulty to sustain that on an ongoing basis. But we've always maintained the majority of those appointments are filled and the operational outputs of the unit is never impacted. So we continue to provide those units both in Lebanon and in other missions across the world. We've 13 missions, international missions currently.
Now, it's been said by many people over the years to us that, you know, Lebanon was great. It paid the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, you know, because of the allowances that are paid in addition to the basic salary, that the troops can do well.
They can. The allowances are good, but they've been the same for a number of years. So we can always look at increasing that in the future. But people don't go overseas just for the money. It's the experience. So certainly anyone who joins the Defence Forces, once they complete their training, their immediate priority is to get an overseas deployment and, as I said earlier, to test themselves and challenge themselves. And that's something that we'll look to in the future. So I suppose you asked me earlier what would be the future for overseas deployments. I would say that the world is more unstable now than it ever has been. So who knows what mission will come up in the future. If there are options that are aligned with Ireland's national interests, I will provide advice to the Minister and to government as to what roles the Defence Forces could play in any new mission that may emerge in the coming years.
You know, when those kind of missions are being weighed up, would there be, an assessment of the dangers of those missions, or would you go in, like in Sierra Leone, very dangerous place, the Irish Army were there?
Absolutely. Everything we do involves risk.
So Gaza, for example.
Everything is an option. And I suppose what we'd have to look at is, first of all, you have to have the consent of the host nation or the parties involved in any conflict, and then a UN Security Council resolution at the moment or some other form of a mandate to allow for a mission to take place. But the Defence Forces is like the Swiss Army knife of the Irish state. We can provide any kind of capability or function that government approves. So we could provide anything from securing headquarter locations to ground holding like we do in Lebanon, patrolling or working alongside other international partners. But Ireland would never do any mission on its own in an international
And partner. Also, I mean, given that Ukraine, we know that NATO membership has been ruled out by Trump, certainly. So if Ukraine in a post-war situation is not going to be in NATO, it'll be another kind of force that will have to be in the buffer zone or whatever may ensue. And the Irish Army could be part of that, I presume.
The Defence Forces, it may be a combination of Army, Air Corps, Navy. It's a very complex operating environment, Ukraine itself. Again, government will decide what the Defence Forces do. But like I said, we've operated in missions with the UN, with NATO and with European Union. So we have experience there and we are considered as valuable partners in any international operation.
Now, one of the big problems for any Chief of Staff, and it's still on your desk, is recruitment and then retention. How big a problem is that? I mean, where are we in terms of the full strength of the defence forces? How shy are we of that figure?
Okay, so current strength is just under 7,700. So we're about 2,000 shy of our current establishment. And obviously, we have the Commission on Defence Forces has set us a great target to increase the force, which is really positive and one that I would see as a huge opportunity. On the recruitment side, it continues to be really positive. So we've the brand of the Defence Forces remains really strong. Our application numbers have increased steadily in the last few years, and we've got a new head of strategic HR. So we put a whole range of mechanisms in place to ensure that we remain attractive to the marketplace. Currently, we offer starting salaries in the Defence Forces for a young recruit who starts, and after 26 weeks, they can earn up to 42,000 euros per annum.
And what age can they enter at?
So 18 and up to 39. So we've even increased the
okay. So at the age of 18 or 19, you could be on 40 grand a year.
Yep. Yeah, and with opportunities to serve overseas, and then there are additional allowances as people upskill themselves and become more specialists in other areas. There are incentives there for people to better themselves and to reward them for the service they provide.
Typically, where would they serve? I mean, and is there any kind of army accommodation for single young soldiers?
Yeah, so there's huge investment. You mentioned that earlier. So we've got an increase in our allocation of funding for infrastructure specifically. So we're going from 56 million this year to 97 million on infrastructure in the Defence Forces next year. That's from office buildings, accommodation, gym facilities, new medical facilities. So the goal is that the Defence Force in the future will provide single accommodation to personnel. We're not there yet. We've a way to go, but we are bringing in new accommodation blocks across the Army, Naval Service and Air Corps. And the goal is that provides a retention incentive for personnel.
Now, when you look right across the Defence Forces, the stories we hear all the time about retention of people, particularly in the Air Corps, which ultimately is going to become the Irish Air Force, is it not?
Yeah.
And the Navy as well, when ships can't take to sea because of a lack of personnel. I mean, those are very critical problems. These are not people that you can just train up in 2 months.
Yeah. So I think the country is at full employment. The Irish Ogilvy na hÉireann soldier, sailor and aircrew are highly attractive to employers out there. And retention is a challenge. And that's an area that we're going to focus on in the next number of years. So we want to retain our personnel, our most valuable asset. So we have had challenges with numbers, and that does have to have an impact then on operations. So, but despite that, we continue to deliver on all of our services. So today we have ships on patrol in our maritime domain area. We have in the Air Corps, we have an aeromedical service. We have the support of the Gazoo. We're providing maritime patrol aircraft. The Army, we have, you mentioned earlier about the engineer search. We have EOD teams, and we have a battle group on standby, a company of personnel on standby to deploy anywhere in the globe pending government approval, as well as all the other outputs that we continue to deliver on in line with our government tasking. So we continue to deliver on our outputs, but it does put a strain on our personnel.
Now, the government has promised lots more money for Army resources or Defence Forces resources in terms of our vulnerabilities. I mean, I presume you war game these vulnerabilities all the time in the Defence Forces.
Absolutely. So everything is based on risk and threats. And what we would say is that the threats facing Ireland and the state and Europe, they're pacing threats. So they're continually changing. So we have to adapt and change. So the goal of the future Defence Forces is that we become fit for purpose, we become more agile and more adaptable to the threats that Ireland faces. And Ireland does face threats both overseas, but also at home. And we're very familiar with those. You'll have heard about, you know, the subsea areas, our critical infrastructure undersea. We've had Russian aircraft patrolling in our airspace or passing through our airspace. So these are all threats that we have to mitigate, but there are also threats on land as well. So here in Ireland, there are state actors who are working to their own national interest that can be a threat to Ireland. So our Army service provides responses to that as well. So in the future, we're going to see a change in how the Defence Forces is structured, both in the command, but in the services. So as you said, we'll have an Army headquarters commanded by a single Army commander, and we'll have a Chief of the Navy and a Chief of the Air Force of the future. They're just not name changes. They're showing that the Defence Forces will be focused on national defence.
But will they have the budgets to do the kind of things?
Yeah.
I mean, you can be head of the Navy and like the admiral who never went to sea in the Gilbert and Sullivan operas, you know, because there's nothing there for them to command.
Well, we're dealing with reality, and I suppose the funding is positive. So we've seen the National Development Plan, where we've seen a step change in funding for defence. So we've gone up by 54%. So in the next 5 years, for capital projects alone, so for the likes of buying equipment, we're going to see investment of up to 1.7 billion in defence and in the defence forces. That's a significant change, and it's in line with what the government have set for that level of ambition too. So to have more conventional capabilities for the defence forces in order that we can provide for the defence of the state and enhance national resilience. So,
and when you're sourcing this kind of equipment, I know some contracts have already gone out to tender and maybe some decisions have been made. How do you do that? Are there any kind of guidelines that you have to buy within the EU, for example, or is it a global market?
So we're aligned with government procurement practices. So we have specific governance groups within the Department of Defence and the Defence Forces that look at every single project that comes through. And if they're above certain financial thresholds, we have different layers of governance that we put on those. So we follow those with regard to the recent project for the subsea domain awareness. The towed sonar that the Naval Service brought about, we've done that on a government-to-government basis, and that's in line with government practice as well. And then we have the major radar project that's currently in train, and we hope to have that concluded by the end of this year, and that may be government-to-government or some other method as well. But it's all in line with public spending policies.
And what about intelligence gathering? I mean, there is an Army Intelligence Service.
It's actually a joint one, so it's from the three services. So we've a new Irish Military Intelligence Service is its new rebrand. We've got a new headquarters. It's a state-of-the-art facility, and we have state-of-the-art operators in our intelligence service. We work closely with international partners, military partners, and I have to say it's part of, I mentioned earlier, national defence and national resilience. They're a key enabler of our national defence and national resilience. Work closely with An Garda Síochána, and then I or my director of intelligence will advise the minister or the government on issues of concern or issue or interest.
You know, when you go to international meetings of military personnel, and these can be to do with partnerships for peace or whatever it might be, are you ever made to feel like the poor man at the rich man's table? Because we are a small country with the small defence forces.
Well, I haven't had that opportunity. Yes, as you said, I've just started in June of this year. So, but I do. So, as chief of staff, I represent the defence forces at the EU level. So, when the chiefs of defence of the EU countries meet, and also because we're involved in the NATO mission in Kosovo, we attend the briefings with regard to that particular mission. So, I will in the future. So, I think October is my first visit to the EU level, and I'll meet with my fellow Chads. But there is a very close connection. All of the European states, NATO states, face similar challenges around financing, around strength of their forces. So Ireland is seen as a credible partner, as I said earlier, and people want to partner us. They want to see Ireland involved, particularly at the EU level, where we can add value in any mission or any staffing that is ongoing. So, and we have personnel deployed in support of the Ukraine mission. So there's a headquarters there that provides training for the Ukrainian armed forces outside of Ukraine, obviously in Germany and Poland. But we have a staff there, and we also provide training teams that support the Ukrainian armed forces. So we're really valuable partners.
If you were asked to describe or offer what the Irish soldier has that maybe others don't, I mean, what might that be? Be it the officer or the rank and file?
So what we say is we're warriors, we're diplomats, and we're scholars. So our professional military education prepares our personnel, both in all three services, Army, Navy, and the Air Force, for any type of role. So they're adaptable, they're professional. We teach people how to think, not what to think. So when they deploy on any missions, they can add value. Obviously, we're English speaking. That's a unique asset for the Irish officer, NCO.
Because it's the global language.
It is, but it's certainly in military circles it is. And Irish personnel, when they do deploy, I have seen constantly the feedback and praise of mission commanders, of politicians, when they see what the Irish soldier delivers overseas, but also in Ireland here. I think our politicians, our ministers, our Taoiseach, our president, are very proud of the service that our Defence Forces personnel deliver on a daily basis, as am I as Chief of Staff.
Now, when you look at the exemplary record of the Defence Forces, there is one stain, and I'm not sure whether that is still on your desk, and that's the legacy of the Women of Honour scandal. Where does that stand now?
So it does rest with me as Chief of Staff, for sure. I would say that, first of all, I want to acknowledge the bravery and the courage of the women and men who came forward at that time. They also engaged with the Independent Review Group that reported in 2023. And since then, we have taken an active role in that. As Chief of Staff, I have a zero tolerance to any inappropriate or bad behaviour within the Defence Forces. And we take active measures in that regard to stamp out such behaviours. We've been very proactive, Pat, I have to say, in the last number of years. We've taken ownership of this challenge. It's not unique to the Defence Forces, but we have a culture change program in place. We've taken active steps internally. So we've created our own bespoke training package called Sexual Ethics and Responsible Relationships Training that we developed. And it provides military specific focus and scenarios whereby we give our personnel tips and tools as to how they can recognise inappropriate behaviour and how to manage it and address it in a meaningful way. And I have to commend the work of the representative associations, the department and our defence leadership in that regard. And we now have a number of independent mechanisms where people can bring complaints where they do witness inappropriate behaviour to an independent grievance manager, which was established by the Minister this summer. We also have the Defence Forces Ombudsman, where people can take independent claims to. And we have our own internal discipline processes as well.
Well, it's a very interesting job, a very challenging job, and I'm sure you're looking forward to doing it for some years.
Absolutely. It's a huge honour and privilege to have been selected as Chief of Staff. One that I relish. I see this as an opportunity for the Defence Forces. There's nothing but positive messaging coming from the financial side, from government in their support for the Defence Forces. And I know our own personnel internally are really energised by the change that's coming as we strive to provide for the defence of the state.
Lieutenant General Russell Mulcahy, Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.